Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 22 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, March 24th, 2018. I received many responses to January's puzzler question. Well, it wasn't a question exactly. The puzzler was more like an accusation designed to trip up climate advocates. What do you say when someone asks you, what are you really doing to address climate change in your life? No doubt you have run into this same scenario. I love the different voicemails you left, so stick around to hear them and our new puzzler question later in the show. But first, are you ready to take a wild trip into the mind of a brilliant author? Joining us is novelist Claire Vey Watkins. She is here to talk about cli-fi, or climate fiction. Claire actually started writing her climate change novel even before she heard the term cli-fi.
The first time I heard it, I was like, is that a new subgenre of erotica that I don't know about or something? But now I'm realizing that there's a really rich new tradition of telling these types of stories that try to imagine something that's really hard to imagine, like the future of our species.
And that is what Claire Vey Watkins does so powerfully in her novel Gold Fame Citrus. Claire is going to tell us about her book and her writing process. But let me warn you, she will go to deep and at times difficult places. In doing so, she has unearthed wisdom in addressing climate change. First, I'll give you an overview of the story. The book is Gold Fame Citrus by Claire Vey Watkins. The setting, it's a parched Southern California of the near future. There are two main characters. Luz had been the poster child for the country's conservation movement, and her boyfriend, Ray, is an army deserter turned surfer. Together, they are squatting in a starlet's abandoned mansion. They can't easily travel east because armed vigilantes keep Californians from the lusher regions of the country. Some people have allowed themselves to be evacuated to encampments in the east. But Luz and Ray are holdouts. They subsist on rationed cola and water and whatever they can loot, scavenge, and improvise. For the moment, the couple's fragile love, which somehow blooms in this arid place, seems enough. But when they cross paths with a mysterious child, the thirst for a better future begins. So Ray and Luz are the two main characters, but looming large is the desert. It is almost a living thing.
Yeah, that was the first character in the book, the Amargosa Dune Sea. I was so delighted when I learned that that's what geologists call a very, very, very big sand dune field, a dune sea. I was like, yes, all right. Because what I wanted to do partly was like cannibalize the language of science and fact and also bureaucracy and industry and infrastructure and propaganda and use all that language to tell the story about how those things fail us, basically, you know? So the Dune Sea was the first character that I came up with. And it really at first wasn't any more sophisticated of an impulse than just like watching Planet Earth, David Attenborough, deserts, I think it's episode 7 in season 1, and learning and listening to him describing the Gobi Desert, the largest desert on planet Earth, and I was just like, but what if it wasn't, you know? And just wanting to write about a super accelerated desertification process.
The Dune Sea is ever expanding and burying everything in its path. Having grown up in the West, now living in Michigan, the story echoes the feelings of loss and nostalgia Claire has about home.
It's basically like burying the place, and it's my home that I'm burying, you know, the Mojave Desert, and I have these passages about everything that's underneath it anymore, because I have felt like especially living so far away from home, it does feel like I could go back and it could be gone. I mean, streams are gone, lakes are gone, aquifers that took geologic time to accrue are drained, and it is kind of a phantasmagoric transformation of the landscape, and it doesn't seem too far-fetched to think at one point it might be unrecognizable to me as my home. It is a nostalgic project. It's partly elegy, really. It's like homesickness times to the power of what if your home, when you go back to it, isn't as you recognize it anymore. So it starts for me in the Owens Valley, in the Eastern Sierras, where Owens Lake is. But Owens Lake is a misnomer. It's not really a lake anymore. It's been drained. It was drained by the Los Angeles Aqueduct Project in the early decades of the 20th century. I've met people actually on book tour who lived in the Owens Valley and farmed there when it was Owens Lake and when it was the water that ran off the eastern side of the Sierras, and they had a modest but functioning agrarian society there. And now it's like a white salt flat. Their home is gone.
Claire started her story with existing conditions, the changes already happening in the world because of the impact of humans on the land. But then she wanted to use her imagination to go big and imagine scenarios that didn't yet happen but could. This is where she ran into some trouble.
This is a good example of this thing that kept happening over and over again, where I would think that I was making something up, something crazy and something sci-fi and something kind of fun. Like, I'd be like, oh, what if there was like this? Oh, that'd be fun. And then I came up with this idea, taking this image of Lake Mead, where, you know, the Colorado River gives all of the Southwest, everyone who lives in the Southwest is drinking water from the Colorado River. And I read a lot of science writing about the Colorado River at first and learned, reread Cadillac Desert and these things. But I didn't get into like the image-driven stuff until I came up with this idea about Lake Mead. And I just thought, what if they installed basically a drain at the bottom of Lake Mead and then like drained the whole thing like a bathtub? Quick Google reveals that, in fact, that infrastructure project is complete. And this book came out, the month that it came out, this project, which is called The Straw, like a drinking straw, The Straw opened and was in effect, and people in Las Vegas drank water that came from this straw, this bathtub drain at the bottom of Lake Mead, the same month that Gold Fame Citrus came out. And I kept trying to invent crazy things. I wanted it to be proportioned really big, almost like satirically. What if they slingshot dynamite into the clouds trying to trigger rainfall? And then it would be like, well, University of Oklahoma got a grant to do that in 1870. You know, everything that I could come up with that people doing to water or responding to climate had already happened, had a historical antecedent. And so I realized that I was writing a much more realist book than I wanted to believe. And I don't know if I would have written it if I had realized that I would have to really actually take it seriously.
And in researching it and writing it, Claire began to learn about the people already living like they were in a cli-fi novel. The future is here now.
A problem that I had approached speculatively and in the future tense was actually in the present tense, that it was here for people. And I believe the first American city or town to be relocated because of climate change was a native village in Alaska. And that just, to me, is a powerful example of this, that for some, the future is already here. They're already a post-apocalyptic society. I mean, I've heard Native writers even describe their today now as a post-apocalyptic moment. There are already climate refugees among us today dying. That you had to really like take the stories a lot more seriously. So that process that you're talking about realizing that the future is here now, it happened to me again and again with every Every time I tried to invent something, I would find out that I had not invented that at all.
So is her cli-fi book about the future we face, or is it about the present realities we must recognize?
Everything in Gold Fame Citrus, it pretends to be about the future, but it's actually about the past. You know, it's sort of a reversal of the Dust Bowl, and the way that the migrants are imprisoned looks a lot like internment camps for Japanese Americans. So part of this looking forward has also got to be excavating these buried and forgotten stories of resilience and death and the interplay between the two of them, listening to survivors.
Claire sets the novel in a faded, broken down, mostly abandoned California. She is piercing the bubble of what California and Hollywood has become in many people's minds.
I think it was kind of an impulse of wanting to make like a big graveyard over all these places that were mirages to begin with. Americans told a lot of lies to facilitate westward expansion, right? That it's our divine right, that manifest destiny, we deserve to be there, that man will conquer nature. Rain follows the plow. If we manipulate the earth and structures that we're capable with our American exceptionalism, that the climate will respond in kind. There's a sort of pathetic fallacy there, right? Now we know, not at all. I wanted people, I think, to weep for California, you know, and to ask, like, what does America mean without California, you know? And it's been, like, our dream machine for so long, and sometimes I noticed about the drought, this tendency for media that wasn't based in the West to, I called it Schadenfornia. It would just be sort of like, well, that's what you get with, you know, it was almost like they've had this decadent lifestyle and this moderate climate for so long, and that's what you get.
On this program, we've talked about climate communication. We've raised the question about fear tactics. In episode 14, Apocalypse Now, we considered the pros and cons of using fear as a tool. Hollywood blockbusters thrive on the end-of-the-world scenarios. Some climate advocates use these in hopes of waking people up. Claire is curious about how apocalypse stories affect us.
Post-apocalyptic literature is actually, or can be, quite escapist. There's a version of it that takes kind of a hard look at what we're doing and what the future might be in store for us. But there's also things like The Day After Tomorrow. And like, if there's a blockbuster version of something, you can probably suspect that there's some escapism involved in it, right? So it's a curious genre that way. There are versions inside of it that are trying to be honest and like brutally so.
These rapid changes already affecting our lives are curious for another reason. They have been brought on by humans polluting. We have altered the land, the seas, and the air.
But then there's a kind of an irony here, because that propaganda about human beings manipulating the weather in godlike proportions, it is happening now, but just not as anyone would have hoped or is really maybe even willing to reckon with. So there is something kind of godlike about man-made climate change, changing the weather. I was drawn to the phrase, an act of God. You know? Like, how do you understand that phrase in Houston or in Puerto Rico right now? You know? Was that God? Was that us?
Was that God? Was that us? The process of writing the book caused Claire to ask deep questions. Questions that many of us do not like to consider. As climate advocates, we train ourselves to look for hope and ways forward. We need to keep ourselves positive so we don't discourage others or ourselves. But writers have the opportunity and the burden to imagine the unimaginable.
one of the questions that comes up for me when I'm writing about climate, it goes right to suicide for me, because I don't really know how else to understand this current moment where we have the science, we have the knowledge of what's happening, but we continue to do it. That seems like a suicidal, a suicidal impulse. And how to make sense of loving, being alive at a kind of moment when the lemmings are like going off the cliff.
This is hard stuff for climate advocates to hear. We know offering hope in all of our presentations is essential. Claire gets this, but recognizes she has a different role to play.
There is room for radical hope in storytelling, and we can tell stories about another way to have our society. I mean, we've had the dystopian genre for a long time, but it used to be sort of hopeful. And the question of hope is a big one. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written about it, Claudia Rankine and others very compellingly. The question of, like, has hope been essentially just an opiate and a denial tool for a long time? Because I do see a lot, what I see a lot in this world is, here's a story of pain and the fallout from climate change, but hope. And you're like, I can completely understand that impulse to retreat, and it feels good, and it has been. It's part of the expectations of, like, Aristotelian storytelling is, like, uplift at the end. But it doesn't seem honest in this particular moment.
I don't know about you, but this is where I struggle. I know we are at a critical moment in history. I'm looking to fellow humans, particularly leaders, to wake up and act. The weight of the reality of where we are in history weighs on me. And how do we get the public to feel and understand the importance of this moment?
I was talking to Ruth Ozeki about this.
The novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest.
A couple of years ago, and she said, maybe our species just doesn't have the tools to conceptualize climate change. Like, maybe this is the limit of our innovation and our advancement, that we can't really get our heads around geologic time and the difference between weather and climate, and we can't really do... I mean, we can have Bill McKibben explain it to us so many times, but, like, will we feel it, the way we feel Beowulf, or the way we feel the Odyssey, or the way we feel Game of Thrones. Like, that's a different type of meaning, you know, and that's, like, on the intuitive level. So when I say, like, speaking to the hearts and the guts and the loins, I think that's got to be a cooperative storytelling endeavor that emphasizes interconnectedness.
So much of the climate conversation over the past 10 years has been shaped by people who dismiss climate change is even happening. They deny humans are guilty for causing it, and they overlook our responsibility to fix it.
Basically, it forced us into a question where it's like, fact or fiction, like, is it or isn't it real? And so the tools of storytelling that we've been using, that climate change activists and scientists have been using, are from science, and they're about, like, the facts, and, like, this is actually the data, and this is why this study that says that about the data is not a sound study, and so on. But that is not the best mode of understanding, like, the unsayable and the unknowable and getting into, like, that emotional component, you know. And it seemed to me like fiction, art, and narrative storytelling was a way in to making this phenomenon felt in the guts, in the loins, in the hearts. We weren't able to move on and say, yes, and what will that look like for you and your loved ones?
Claire believes our storytelling skills can help us think and act in new ways.
The epigraph for Goldfame Citrus comes from Robert Mulholland when he opened the Los Angeles Aqueduct, which took the water from Owens Lake and brought it to Los Angeles. He said, there it is, take it. And that's what it's been. It's like, take, 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 take. And I think what we're coming up against is, like, we've taken all we can take. And now it's time to think about a different way to arrange our society and deal with these challenges.
Claire reveals a truth that has become even more clear for her through this intense writing process. She understands we need to listen deeply to learn from others. Towards the end of our time together, we chatted about examples in the past of communities who faced awful challenges and discovered ways forward. One example was the early HIV/AIDS crisis. A small group of people were suffering, but most of the world either didn't know or didn't care. In the early 1980s, even the U.S. government ignored the problem as hospitals turned AIDS patients away. If we listen, we can learn from past struggles.
That's very powerful to me, that analogy between the AIDS epidemic, because we do have communities who have endured, and we have incredible resilience within our society if we just listen to them, you know? And that's the role for storytelling, too, and not just telling a story and getting people to act, but listening to the stories that we don't really listen to.
I am grateful for the opportunity to speak with Claire Vey Watkins and for her book, Gold Fame Citrus. She urges me to listen deeply and to tell stories that move people to act in a new way.
We have to be really urgent with the storytelling because we need to rearrange our society to handle this change. When you think about the shameful inequality and injustice in our society, that has had enough. Like, we've had enough.
As you can hear, Claire has a lot of important things to say about climate change and storytelling. You can learn more about Claire Vey Watkins and her books of fiction at her website, clairevaywatkins.com. Now it is time for our puzzler question. So last puzzler, you were at a community event talking to a neighbor, let's call him Greg. You revealed your passion about climate change and climate solutions. Greg looked you up and down and said, "So I guess you don't use any fossil fuels yourself? You don't drive a car, travel by plane, or heat and cool your home? What are you actually doing to address climate change in your own life?" Yeah, that's not a question. That's an accusation designed to shut you down. But it happens a lot. So how do you answer Greg's question? I heard from a lot of men who had great answers to the question. I wonder if that means men get this accusation more than women. I don't know. Bruce Hagen from Santa Clara, California, left this voicemail.
"Hey, I'm with you on that. I say, if you don't walk the talk, you're wasting your breath. But tell me this, do you think that we can solve global warming if we just depend on conscientious people like you and me to shrink our carbon footprint, especially when our economic system seems to encourage climate pollution by making it free to pollute? What do you think? I call this approach rise to the bait and swallow the fisher because I immediately agree with him and pull him into my point of view. Anyway, thanks. Keep up the good work. Talk to you soon. Bye."
Paul Perkins in Bath, Maine, wrote in the following answer. "First, you disarm the critic by agreeing with Greg and letting him know that you fully accept the validity of his criticism. You go on to say that he has put his finger on the heart of the issue, namely, we are dependent on fossil fuels, and transitioning to a clean energy society will take collaboration, innovation, creativity, and perseverance. Furthermore, you welcome his willingness to be frank, and you welcome any ideas he may have to address climate change." Continuing with the voicemails, David Kane had this to share.
"And my response is, Greg, I want you to know, first of all, that your question mark is right on the mark. It's something that my wife and I struggle with. After all, who wants to be all hat and no cattle? We're slowly turning the screws as we emotionally come to terms with the realities of global warming. One of our dreams once we retired was to see the world, to travel like my parents did. But I've been telling my children and grandchildren that jumping on a plane is almost the worst thing that one can do, offsets notwithstanding. So it has involved real sacrifice. It's hard, Greg, to give up on a dream.
Finally, I received this message from Ted Obard in Berkeley, California.
Well, I would hope that I would use humor and join him in his ambivalence about climate action. Maybe something like, well, I can tell you what I'm not doing. I am definitely not trying to will myself to become a self-sacrificing saint, because that is not going to happen. And then maybe, you know, it's confusing, right? How can I care about climate and also be selfish? I mean, I do want to drive my car and heat my house and fly in planes, and I also want to fight climate change. It's normal, right, to want to help, but also want what we want, right? At some point, I'd want to weave in, you know, for me, it's super important to be real with myself about that balance. I do some individual way actions, you know, in terms of my car and house and such. But beyond that, I need help. I mean, this shouldn't be, I don't think it can be on any one of us. It's just not going to work. And in my experience, it just makes me feel bad about myself, right? And then I would listen again. My guess is that I'll connect on some level. And, you know, ultimately, I'd want to segue into a carbon fee and dividend pitch, right? It's fair. We all pay for what we pollute. It's not too much for anyone. The dividend covers the most needy. And because it's shared, it's on a scale that's effective. My hope is that with a little self-deprecating humor and an invitation to air out his own ambivalence, we could find a way to connect.
Thank you, Bruce, Paul, David, and Ted. And thanks to everyone else who sent in an answer. So, are you ready for our next puzzler question? Here goes. On Facebook, you encouraged people to engage in climate action and join your group. A friend of yours, let's call her Samantha, comments, "Yeah, that's very noble of you, but really the only solution is going to be a technical one. It's gone too far. They're going to have to geoengineer a solution, so don't stress about it. They're working on a fix somewhere." So what do you say to Samantha, who believes geoengineering will solve all of our climate woes? We should just live our lives until the patch is available. Get back to me by April 15th, 2018. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at 573-483-8194. Plus one, if calling outside the USA. That number again is 570-483-8194. Thank you for listening to today's show. Storytelling is a topic that will come up again. Next month, we welcome Dr. Lisa Van Susteren, who will talk about mental health issues and climate change. Citizens Climate Radio is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support comes from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance comes from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All of the music we use on the show is licensed, unless otherwise specified. Please be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Also, rate and review us on iTunes. Oh my gosh, please. It would make me so happy. You can hear Citizens Climate Radio on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, Podbean, Northern Spirit Radio, Google Play, Player FM, and TuneIn Radio. Also, feel free to connect with other listeners and chat about the show over at our Citizens Climate Radio Facebook page. You can follow us also on Twitter at CitizensCRadio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guests. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.